Station number 16059, John Court, Reel 6.
Mr. Court, Reel 6. You were discussing George Skeets.
Yes.
Did these bad nerves affect his driving?
No, I don't think so. He was an excellent driver.
So it's only when he was outside the tank that he would become...
Yes, I think, you know, from what I know and from what I've observed... I mean, George, once he was in action, in a tank, he was okay. It was the fact that I always felt that he was vulnerable when he was outside a tank. Possibly, you know, I think that that is something which... I suppose also, a tank man, when you're in a tank, it's like your little home. You feel vulnerable when you're outside. If we were Stukas, we'd always get back in the tank. There have been times when we, later in part of the war in North Africa, we had some infantry with us and we were getting badly stonked. And a couple of the infantry fellows climbed inside the tank, and we closed down, and immediately they wanted to get out. They felt claustrophobic. I mean, they just couldn't stand it. The banging inside to us was normal, I mean, but they wanted to get out, so we had to let them out. They became so agitated that they had to get out. But we were the other way around. I mean, outside we felt very vulnerable.
Did George Skeets say anything about his experiences in...
No. George was very, very, very dour sort of fellow.
So he didn't have anything to explain his...
No. I know we used to talk about it, you know, and as I say, it's a strange thing that one, you know, you never sort of think although another strange thing, although I'm jumping ahead a long way, but Jack Barnes, I mean, before Goodwood, I mean, we were sitting chatting before Goodwood, and Skeets, Barnes and myself, and Jack said, well, you know, tomorrow's my day. So we looked at him and said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, I cop it tomorrow. So we said, you know, don't be silly. You know, we've all said this at some time, that we're, you know, tomorrow's our day. But we said, well, you know, we get through the day. Yes, he said, but I know. He said, tomorrow's my day. So, and he said, I'll tell you something else. He said, I know where it's coming. It's coming straight through the front. And we said, you know, in fact, if you feel that strongly, tell you what we do. We'll put a few extra tracks. So we took tracks and lashed them on the front of Jack's tank. And we went in, and Jack was killed, and it came straight through the front. But the very strange thing about it, and this is something I don't understand, Jack, my hometown's Leatherhead, and Jack Barnes came from Epsom. This is how I came to get to know Jack. And George Skeets came from Ash in near Guildford. This, I think this is why we became... most of the lads were Midlands and Northern lads. And now I live in a cul-de-sac at Leatherhead, and my mother lives opposite a lady who knew Jack's mother. And my mother said to me, I've been talking to Mrs. Allen, she said, and she said that Jack, as I discuss this, she said Jack was killed, she said, and Evelyn, his mother... I don't believe these things, but it makes you wonder. She said that Jack's mother went to a seance, and she said she spoke to Jack, and Jack said, "Oh, he's quite all right. He's quite happy now. He's sorry he had to leave, but and that he was killed by a bad head wound." Now, how did she know? I'd never discussed. But how did Jack's mother know that Jack... I mean, was it just something that... Because nobody else... I mean, nobody was said that... In fact, he took his head off. but nobody would say how he died. But that made me think an awful lot. Mind you, this I didn't know this until after the war, but it did make me think a great deal about you know, these things. As I say, I'm very skeptical, but there you are. That's
was Jack generally reliable? And
yeah, Jack was good. He was a good driver. Yes, yes.
You mentioned that you took part in two of the actions in which you took part as a gunner.
Yes.
Were there any others where you were in action as a gunner? Any other occasions other than the dealing with the bunker and then the attack on the Italian convoy?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. The funny thing, I can't remember when we were just before Alamein. Yes, I'd become a driver then. I think I was a driver then when we went down on the Contrada Depression.
So you had two actions as a gunner, and then you were
back in the driver's seat. That's right, yeah. Yes. Driving, as I say, that was driving. I was driving a Grand then.
Did you go into action at all before the Battle of Alamein as a driver?
I can't remember. I had an idea. I can't remember.
Do you remember in the period before Alamein doing any new forms of training or preparation for the battle?
No, I don't think so. I can't really remember any specific training. I know all our fitters were busy, you know, sort of, it was just general maintenance, as far as I remember. No, I can't remember any specific training as such.
Did you have any warning that you were about to be involved in a major offensive?
Well, yes, we knew there was something coming up, but we didn't know when or to what extent. But we knew we were building up for something. We could tell by the amount of movement, not just roundabout, and. We were getting a lot of attention then from Stukas. I can remember a great deal of attention from Stukas. And also the at night time, that used to fascinate me, that we would leaguer up way out in the desert. And they used to drop these, what would you call them? Star shells on a parachute. We see the chandeliers that used to hang up there for a year, ages. And the whole of the ground, and you would see, although we would break them up a bit with our nets, to me, the echelons were in the soft skins, were in the center, and the tanks around the outside. And to me, it looked like one great blot on the and how they could keep going over and coming back and going over again and not find us, it used to fascinate me. But occasionally they would find you and drop a few. But never, as far as I can remember, never anything very close. It was, you know, usually on the outskirts of the... But I can never remember ever the echelon actually being bombed. So they used to search for us. And if I remember rightly, there was one time when... they mistook, and I don't know whether it was an Italian or German echelon, which was a couple of 3 miles away, and dropped their load on those instead of on us, which we were quite pleased about. But, you know, the desert's a very strange place. You can lose yourself very easily, as you may guess. I know one particular night I left the echelon, and just tend to the nature, and I walked away from the tank, and I thought I was walking in a straight line. I thought, okay, well, all I've got to do is do what I've got to do, turn around and walk straight back. And it was pitch black, and when I say black, it was black. And So I walked, did what I had to do, turned around and started to walk back. And I walked and I walked, and I thought, hang on, I walked further than I walked out. So I did the old idea, lay close to the ground and look and see if you could see anything against the, although there was, you know, it's never that pitch black in the sky. Couldn't see a thing. So eventually I thought to myself, well, I couldn't have deviated too much. So I walked at a slight angle away, came across some tanks, B squadron, no, we're C squadron. B squadron is over there. Right, okay, turned around, walked towards where B squadron was supposed to be.
Not there.
And then I thought, well, I'll just give it a little few more paces. So I walked a little more. I thought, that's it. Sit down, because you're not going to find them. So I sat there and waited the dawn to break. And they were way away from me. I was walking away from them.
When the regiment was in a Liga,
yes.
How large an area would it be spread over?
Oh, gosh. Well, you've got four squadrons, haven't you? ABC and HQ. You've got all your soft skins. You've got your medics. You're usually one ambulance or two ambulances. You've got the dingoes. That's quite an area. That's what made me say that, you know, when it's in one bunch, you would have think they would see you from the sky, but obviously the sand dunes are throwing certain shadows, so they could easily make you out that, you know.
What sort of distance would there be between individual vehicles then? Get some idea of that.
Oh, not very far. Oh no, you'd be quite close. Tanks would be within about 25, 30 yards from each other. No, I can't ever say that. There was no particular. I think one used to pull in overnight and get in and get loaded up with ammo and petrol and get your head down, because I mean, by the time, especially if you've been out pulling in the quads, by the time you get in, it's very late at night, or in the early hours of the morning. By the time you've filled up with ammo and making sure you've got you haven't got normal petrol, because it was your aviation spirit, and it was amazing that if you got a couple of three flimses, you know, the four flimses of ordinary petrol, and put those in the tanks, that used to make a hell of a difference on a radial engine. It really did. You could there was no pull to it at all. So, you know, you just had to make sure that you had the right juice. By the time you got that in and pulled your bed off the back of the tank and got your head down, you know, that was it. And, of course, you were up again first light. I don't think, I can never remember actually saying, well, you know, this is a distance apart. I mean, your commander used to jump down, and if you were, used to perhaps sometimes guide you, other times if there was a tank there, you just pulled in beside it and stopped, you know, and that was it. There was no definite, I can never remember any definite, obviously there was an order of coming into the echelon, but, you know, no definite spacing or anything like that, you know, it was just a case of get in and that was it, you know. Sufficient room for the lorry to come round and feed you with the ammunition and petrol and that sort of thing, you know.
You mentioned that you attacked by Stuka, presumably those were daylight attacks.
Daylight attacks, yes, yes.
Did they ever manage to inflict any damage?
No, strange enough. Again, the softskins used to catch it, unfortunately. But I can never, ever remember a tank ever being put out of action, not by Stukas. We were more likely to be hammered by, because they used to mount, I believe they're Bofors, on the back of 3-ton lorries. And when they used to come in and drop their load and sort of come in, especially if the Messerschmitts were with them, and they used to just hop over the sand dunes, the Bofors boys used to get very enthusiastic, you see, and they used to bring their gun down, and quite often you could see, you know, you see the shells bouncing along the sand, you know. They weren't exactly, they used to drop them a bit too low. But, no, I can never remember, I can remember, but this was much later. I was up near, way up in the desert on the run back, that we were attacked by Stukas. And I was sitting in the driver's seat, looking up, and saw them pull out. And I saw this black object coming down. And it's amazing. You sit there and you see it coming down, and you don't, well, I suppose you do think it's a bomb, but you're watching it coming down, and it looks as though it's actually coming right down through where you're sitting. And it wobbles and then it straightens out, but you know, it was way off. I mean, it was 20 or 30 yards. They ran the line along beside the tanks, but it's quite fascinating. It really is. You know, you. But again, it's funny. You. It's more interesting, I suppose. Funny word to use, I suppose, in wartime and in action, but. Lots of things were interesting.
You mentioned that you can get lost in the desert.
Yes.
Especially at night.
Oh, yes, very easily.
Did you feel comfortable living in the desert?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, I can remember when we first arrived out there. I can't think of his name there, the major. We all thought we were very, very fit.
He made you run.
And that's right. He took us... He took us out in a truck, away from the tanks, and he said, "Now I want you to get back to the tanks as quickly as possible." And I know, walking through that soft sand, by the time we got back to the tanks, we were whacked. Mind you, it was the heat of the day as well. And he said, "Now you know what it is to have to bail out and walk any distance." And that was a big lesson. Yeah, we never forgot that. That was something that you do remember. Yes.
Roughly how much sleep would you get?
Not more than 4 hours, 4 to 5 hours, if that. Very short period of time. I mean, there's been many a time when we've been travelling from one area to another, and this is the only time that I used to think to myself, why the heck am I a driver? Because you'd look back in the tank, and everybody else is, although you're going along, I mean, you're watching the lights of the tank ahead of you, because, you know, you've just got I used to work on the two exhausts used to glow, and I used to look at those. And the other thing was that the goggles which they supplied, which were rubber goggles, weren't very good, and I sent home, and my father sent me a pair of motorcycle goggles that had fur, which used to—I mean, nothing used to keep the sand out. I mean, the fine sand always got in, and your eyes were always red and very runny. But as I say, I used to either very rarely could you see the lights ahead, but if they were, and you used to get up as close as you could, because if you were traveling through a minefield, they used to mark it off, you know, with the old tins with the holes punched in them so you could see them, and the white tapes, of course. I used to tuck up as close as I could behind the tank in front, basically because once you got away from him, the amount of the sand that he was throwing up, you couldn't see the tapes or the tins or anything. But I used to look back in the tank if we were on a long march, especially around when we did that marathon loop. And you look back in the tank, and everybody's asleep, you know, except you. And of course, obviously, the commander is awake. But I often used to think to myself, God, I could have a good night's sleep. But it's something, again, which I mean, when you think that you used to have the old blankets. I used to have the two-man tents, and we used to cut them and fold them over, put our blankets inside, then rope them up, and then you used to just put them on the back of the tank, rope them on, and then at night time just take it off, and your bed's already made. All you had to do was just slide in, so you just took your boots off, put your boots under for your pillow, and just that's it. And you went off like that.
Sounds like an improvised sleeping bag.
Well, that's right. That's basically the only thing was that getting in and out of it, and you know, that the desert again is very, very. It's very tricky. I mean, you can get out in the morning, and everything's soaking wet and it's freezing cold, and half an hour. I mean, I used to start the engines up, and stand behind by the exhaust pipe, and warm up. But then within an hour, I mean, everything's boiling hot. But and the old story, you know, two blankets underneath is better than two on top, which was quite true. But you know, constantly getting in and out of the blankets and not having opportunity to actually take them out and air them, they used to get a little bit smelly, but especially on the heat of the back of the tank all the time, you see. But I say it's something you accepted. It's.
But was the 4 or 5 hours sleep enough? Did you find that you could maintain
confidence? Well, yes. If you're in action, I think the adrenaline in your system kept you going. You kept you alert, fully conscious. If you were, you know, sort of in a hold down position, just observing the anyway, you weren't. The commander was on alert. Then okay, you could drop off. You know, just lay there and put your head on the side and drop off. But I used to find I had enough sleep. I never used to, never felt, can never say I could ever feel tired. But as I say, in the 4 hours you did have, you slept well.
You mentioned that, you know, your sleeping bag got a bit smelly after
yes.
a while, system use. How do you get on with things like washing and washing clothes?
Well, the easiest thing was with shirts. What we used to do is open up a tin of aviation spirit and take your socks off and drop them in the spirit and drop the shirt in, swirl it around, take it out, screw it out, hang it on the side of the tank, 10 minutes it's dry, put it back on again. You know, there's no problem there.
Did it clean the...
It took the smell out. it's, yes, I never had any problems at all. Whether we all smelled and therefore couldn't smell each other, I don't know. But I think we kept ourselves pretty clean. Limited with the water, of course, and when we were drawing well water up, when the tankers used to come to us and bring us our water, quite a lot of times it was the well water, which was, I suppose you know, is not, soap won't mix with it, nothing mixes with it. I mean, if you try to make tea with it and you put your evaporated milk in, it just curdled, nothing will, when you drink it, it's, I can only describe it, an oily taste. That's the only sort of thing. It's not salty, but nothing will, it won't, you can't lather or anything like that with it. I suppose these people are well up on what this water is. I don't know whether it's. I believe there's a lot of wells out there, oil wells, aren't there? So maybe that's sort of the sort of level on the water. But no, it was water that you could wash with. You could. I mean, we used to break biscuits up into cut the top of a can off, break the biscuits up, and make. Put some condensed milk with it, something like that, and just stir it up. That's right, yes. We basically lived on the biscuits and the oleomargarine. We used to have the big round tins, I think about 7 pound tins, which we used to put on the fire and boil, because in it was an awful lot of salt, I believe, was to stop it melting too much. Well, that was all very well, but, or perhaps the salt was good for us, I don't know. But we used to boil it because, and there used to be like a white or creamy scum used to come to the top, which we used to take off. And then we used to use it after, you know, what was left on the bottom we used to use, because Well, we liked it more that way. It used to spread on our biscuits and the bully beef and things like that. It was quite good.
How much water did they give you every day? What was the ration?
I'm just trying to think what we used to have. We used to keep it. We used to have. On the old Lees and Grants, there was if I remember, just trying to think now. Gosh, it's so difficult. The first Lees and Grants we had had a big container inside.
For water.
For water, yes. And that was where, when the first tanks we had. Now, what was the chap who used to sit that side? Co-driver? Just trying to think. It's funny you can't think, but I can see a big container with a tap on it on the side. I can't remember the first Lees and Grants we had, but after. We had, on the back, we had the small, sort of roundish side. They weren't actually, you know, the 2 gallon, the old-fashioned 2 gallon petrol cans, similar to that, but round. They weren't square. They were sort of a rounded, pressed steel. And they had a rack at both ends. I think there was four of those. Just trying to think. Difficult.
Did you have a strict water discipline, or were you allowed to drink when you felt like it?
No, as far as I can remember, we never had any strict. There's never any great shortage of. I think it was only once or twice when our chaps couldn't get up to us when they ran into a German echelon instead of our own. they lost a few wagons, but that was Dixie Dean. He was our QM, and evidently he was coming up with the rations and ammo and everything to us. Drove into the echelon, and as I say, the desert's a very strange thing. But anyway, Dixie drove in, and jumped down, started walking to the first tank, and realised there were Mark IVs. So promptly ran back, and they shot out, and I think they lost two or three vehicles. But I can't ever remember saying that, you know, once or twice they said, you know, take it easy with the water because, you know, there wasn't all that much. But I think once after Alamein, nearly all the wells were pretty available to us, and I think that all supplies were very good. We never suffered from. I mean, we always had plenty of food. The only thing I always thought was stupid, and I could never understand the mentality. Two things. One, I suppose, was weight saving, and that was the flimsies, which I always felt, you know, that they'd throw maybe, according to how many you wanted, you know, used to sort of say, okay, you take 20 flimsies or whatever, and they throw them down, and I used to listen, and when they used to land on the sand, I'd say, hang on, and sure, and I'd pick one up, and it'd only be half full, or some would even be a quarter full, that I always thought was a terrific waste because, you know, lorries would come along and throw them off, and maybe out of the 20 cans, say half of them would be leaking, and that was a terrific waste. If that was just happening to our own squadron, what was happening throughout the rest of the... But, of course, with the jerry cans, I mean, which were the far superior can. But the thing that I felt was absolute stupidity was bringing us fresh meat up. They used to bring us fresh meat up on the echelon. Now, apart from the fact that by the time we got finished with our action, plus loading, and there was no way that we would settle down to cook a meal. There's no way. So we used to just take it, dig a hole, and drop it in. Now, again, what a waste. Absolute waste. There was no way that we could, and I always used to think that was you know, who are the powers that be that supplied fresh meat. Maybe they thought they were doing us good. I don't know, but no, no way.
What about vegetables? Did you, or fruit? Did you get?
No, no.
Any fresh meat?
No. I'm just trying to think of the compo packs. I know there were ABs. Some used to have fruit in, tin fruit, you know, and also the some used to have boiled sweets in. Some would have chocolate in. I used to always give my cigarette ration up for boiled sweets. I used to just sit and chew boiled sweets. But no, I can't. McConaughey's, bully beef, Ola margarine.
How did you arrange the cooking? Was that done collectively, or did you all cook for yourselves?
No, each tank cooked its own. It was again. Perhaps the loader, he, you know, he's got in behind the 75 millimeter gun. There's a space where the loader can, and invariably they used to use the